listening to The Radiator. 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Irish-born Vermont poet and prose writer Angela Patton. Angela Patton is a native of Dublin, Ireland. She moved to the United States and Vermont in 1977. After graduating from the University of Vermont, she received an MFA in writing from Vermont College. Author of two poetry collections, Reliquaries and Still Listening, both published by Salmon Poetry, Ireland, she's also included in several anthologies, including the WRUV Reader, Now in Color, a Vermont Writers Anthology, Birch Song, Poetry Centered in Vermont, Kudavista Usta, Marvelous Mouth, Drustvo Apokalipsa Slovenia, The White Page, 20th Century Irish Women Poets, and The Breath of Parted Lips, too. Her poems and essays have appeared in literary journals such as Nimrod International, Poetry Ireland, Calyx Journal, The Literary Review, Prairie Schooner, and Michigan Quarterly Review. A senior lecturer in English at the University of Vermont, Angela was a recipient of a 2007 Creation Grant from the Vermont Arts Council and a 2002 Vermont Arts Endowment Grant for Poetry. She was visiting poet at the Frost Place Conference on Poetry and Teaching in New Hampshire in 2012. In 2007, she was poet in residence at Stranmillis University College, Queens, in Belfast. Her memoir about growing up in Dublin, High Tea at a Low Table, was released in September by Windridge Books of Vermont. When I spoke with Angela Patton earlier this month, I began by reading a paragraph from the book and then asking her about it. Here's the paragraph. These fundamental differences formed the basis of our identity as children. We are Irish, we are Catholic, we are poor, and our parents were as different as chalk and cheese. I loved this line because it's informative and it's also very much in the voice of the book. So I asked Angela Patton to talk about these truths and about how these fundamental differences might have contributed to her becoming a poet and a writer.
Well, I think it was fundamental to my consciousness anyway that I grew up in Dublin, and my mother was a Dubliner, but my father was from the country, and he sounded different, he had a different accent, and all of which I talk about in the book, of course. But we identified ourselves as Dubliners, and we were very happy about that. But I think it's only, memoir is an odd thing, because it's only when you look back at it much later that you can make sense of it. So, and when I'm teaching nonfiction or memoir, I always remind students and myself that there are sort of, you're standing in two places. You're back there, but you have one foot in the present where you're looking back and trying to make sense of what happened. And so you have that grown-up perspective. Mm-hmm. And while certainly I was aware of many of those things as a kid, it's only now, looking back at it, that I'm beginning to piece it together. And look, as we all do, I mean, I think we all grow up looking at our parents as these great big icons.
Right. They've always been there and they've always been together.
Right.
And they know what they're doing.
Right. And how much we're like one or like the other, how much we don't want to be like one and do want to be like the other. But then in my experience, it shifts at certain points. You know, you grow up thinking I'm the spitting image of my father, and then you think, whoa, what did I just say? You know, you become a mother and suddenly you turn into your mother, you know. And then it shifts around a bit. So ultimately, I suppose we're like both. But in my family, anyway, I felt that we were very much put in little boxes. Like, oh, Mary's the spitting image of those people and she's just like those people, which was great and unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I adored my dad. I was a real daddy's girl. But he had his problems too, he had his issues. Yeah. But I was very typical in that I was always gravitating to him and not my mother. And then it's probably a very typical way to grow up, but of course mine was peculiarly Irish. Right. Chalk and cheese, that's so, you know, my parents spoke in similes. Yeah. And And it was very rich language. And so they also told stories all the time. Right. So I picked up on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then they also told us what to think. Perhaps more than some parents, you know.
Yeah.
My son always bristles whenever I try to tell him anything, you know.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, we were constantly being told how to behave, what to do, how to think, what to believe.
So did you become a writer when you started to question those lessons, or do you think that you started before that?
Well, you know, a little while ago I was asked to write a short essay called Why I Write.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really enjoyed writing it because it forced me to think about that. And one of the things I wrote was that we were never encouraged to think of ourselves as writers. We were readers, but never writers. I mean, no one ever suggested that I write anything.
Oh, your father's comment about the typing.
Oh, yes. Wasn't that great? One of the many great ironies, you know.
Which I should make you tell now.
Oh, that was funny.
Because I said it.
Well, it is in the book, but after my mother died and my father was living alone, and we would all try, because we all live in different countries, we would try to go spend time with him. And I had been, for years, writing down all these stories, and he loved it when I wrote poems about him or stories. So I came over with my little computer, and I thought, oh, Daddy will be so pleased. And so I read him all this stuff about himself and all of these stories, and he sat there staring at me raptly. And then when I was finished, expecting him to say, aren't you marvelous, he said, and do you mean to say you did all that typing yourself? So, the irony was, too, that he had bullied me into going to typing school, which I loathed.
Right.
And looking back on it, of course, again, I realized my parents were practical people. Why shouldn't they be?
Yeah.
Left to my own devices, I would have screwed everything up, which, in a way, I did. You know, so they tried to rein me in, but they didn't succeed, you know.
There's a lot of humor. So where does that essay appear?
Oh, it was in Green Mountains Review.
Oh, okay.
And I was delighted because there were a whole lot of people who had written essays. It's a series. And people like Stephen Dunn and Ben Aylshire and lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to say slightly different things than in the book.
Yeah.
And more reflective, perhaps.
I was so impressed that you were even able to remember all of these stories. Because not all of them were first-hand things. A lot of them were things that you had heard from other people, from your parents in particular. Have you kept a journal all your life, or did they start to come back?
Well, I have a great memory for words, I have to admit. And my mother recited all the time and memorized all the time. And after she died, my dad started memorizing poems in his old age. And I would send him typed poems and he would memorize them and recite them at the senior citizens.
Your poems.
No, other people's poems. I mean, best loved poems, you know.
Okay.
In fact, I have a whole booklet upstairs of Xerox poems that he loved. And I would try to pick poems I knew he would like, rhyming poems. So that was something that both my parents loved. And I'm good at memorizing. But I think I also have a good memory for words in general. Daniel is far more visual than I am.
Mm.
You know, he can imagine if he's lost his keys, which he frequently does, he can visualize where they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I trace things with words, you know. Remember people's names by remembering the letters or the, you know, the shape of
the
words.
It's harder to find your keys.
Oh, much harder, yeah. Which is why I'm hyper-organized. I make lists.
Are you a list person?
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say.
Yeah, and my sister was kidding with me the other day. She starts every day by making a list. And she said, just like Mammy, you know, every morning. And so it is funny because we have that in common.
Yeah.
But I think also I did write down a lot of the stories over the years. And especially for a long time while my mother was still alive, they would send me cassette tapes. Like a letter on tape. And I still have a whole bunch of them upstairs.
Oh.
Although I thought I would listen to them while I was writing the memoir, but it was a little too painful for me still to listen to their voices.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot, not so many with my mother, but my father sent tapes for years. And then I would send them back. And so I have a lot of stuff with his voice on it. And he had a shake in his hand and he couldn't write. So the tapes were wonderful. But it was also, it was a funny thing, like having the person there. Of course, this was long before Skype or anything. Mm-hmm. And there was something very sweet about it. But it was ancient technology now.
Yeah.
But still a big improvement.
You should maybe get them transferred over.
I probably should, yeah.
But that's a gift to have your
kind
of voices.
Absolutely,
someday
it is.
Someday you'll
hear that. And the accents and everything, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. So I did write down the stories, and then my dad, when I was on the phone with him, I'd write things down after I got off the phone. So I was very conscious of kind of collecting the stories in some ways, but also remembering things. And my brother and sisters helped some. My sister Mary remembered a lot about the neighbors and who they were and who was related to who. And then my brother, too, of course.
That's fun. How many sisters?
I have one brother who's 2 years older than me and twin sisters who are 2 years younger.
Okay.
So I'm right in the middle.
Right, right. And your relationship with your sisters was not great when you were young.
Well,
and it got better.
Yeah. I mean, I completely blame myself for that. I'm not sure that that came across to them in the book. I think they were both quite offended at certain things I said.
Oh, no.
But in my mind, at least, I was just this awful child who seethed with jealousy and was jealous of them because they were adorable and they were younger and there were two of them and they were girls, you know. And so I was a horrible child. I mean, when I think of myself, I think of myself as being this child who was constantly in a snit about something, you know. And I was always looking for attention. We all were, though. I mean, at least the three girls.
Yeah.
But later, we joined forces against the parents,
right,
or my father, especially the big authority figure.
So,
and then we were sort of hippie chicks together.
Yeah. How long ago did you start working on this, or has it sort of been a project that you've always been working on?
Well, not so much that, but I think after my mother died, which was quite a long time ago, in 1988, I wrote a book of poetry that was very much about her and about her death. Mm. And that emerged after she died, and I went to Ireland for her funeral, for her death and her funeral. And then another book of poetry came out that was more about my father. So these, and those are very memoir-like poems in many ways. I just write in stories, you know. And so these stories have been knocking around for a good while, but it was really last summer that this came together as a book, and that was prompted by the fact that I had my very first sabbatical from UVM, and I went over to Dunleary, to Glasthule, where my mother grew up, and spent 2 months there, rented a little house right across the road from where she grew up.
Oh.
And the bedroom window was looking into her old school.
Oh, interesting.
And so I was right in the neighborhood where my granny lived, my Aunt Katie, my Aunt Ina, where we spent so much time as children. And a lot of the girls I went to school with, who are not girls anymore, of course, live around there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wonderful to get to do that. I've been wanting to do that ever since I left Ireland, to not just visit, but go and live there. You know, go to the shops, go get the groceries, you know, actually be in a place of my own. And so it was wonderful to be there.
Yeah.
And I had already written a lot of the stories, but it gave me the impetus to turn it into a book. And then when Windridge decided to publish it, the beginning of last summer, actually Lynn told me that she would publish it if I could have the manuscript to her by the end of May. And my classes don't end until the beginning, the first week of May. And I teach a lot. So I knew I had this short window of time. And I did it. You know, I just completely gave myself up to it. And then, of course, that was just the first draft. But I also decided last summer to contact the FBI about the kidnapping experience.
Right. Yes.
Because I had never known what happened to that man.
Oh, okay.
And so I found out. I tracked it down. And that was another impetus for putting it in the book.
So since that's come up, I was going to ask you about that. You were kidnapped.
Yes.
From a parking lot at the University of Vermont.
Right.
In the 70s?
Or no, 80s? It was 1984.
84.
Yeah.
which is an extraordinary thing.
It was
amazing. But it was a thread that runs through this book, and it was sort of important to the structure of the book. And I wonder, first let's just talk about that.
It was a completely out of the blue episode, you know.
Yeah.
And so I have no way to explain why it happened. It was such a random occurrence. But putting it in the book changed the way I felt about the rest of the book and helped me shape it.
Right. Did you get help from an editor in shaping it, or was that all
organized? I had put a lot of the stories together, but Lynn at Windridge had said that it needed more of a narrative, mm-hmm. more of a narrative arc. Mm-hmm. And at that point, she didn't know about the kidnapping incident, but I put it in. And then it changed things. Mm-hmm. And then I struggled with, you know, where to revisit it in the story and how to weave it in. She was extraordinarily helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Not just with that, but with other things. You know, she was a wonderful editor.
Lynn Stone.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's just wonderful. And she became a friend.
Yeah.
And we like her so much. But also just so skilled. She was so careful, reading it carefully, thinking about it. And even saying things like, this needs something else. I'm not sure what it is, but this paragraph or this transition, or I really think you need to add an epilogue. And I would think, oh, no, I thought I was done. I really don't want to do it. And she would say, no, really, you really need to. So I'd go back and do it.
Yeah.
And I'd push a little further. She was so wonderful, really.
Yeah. So that listeners can have an idea for the book, I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading from it.
I'd love to. And I'll begin with chapter one. On a sunny February afternoon in 1984, I drove into the parking lot at the University of Vermont in Burlington, found a parking space, and switched off the ignition. Then I held my breath, waiting for the explosion. The Subaru was a real lemon in color and condition. I bought it for $500 when I left my marriage and moved into an apartment on my own. I was clueless about cars and terrified of driving, but I had to be able to pick up my son and deliver him to school. I didn't realize I would need to pour quarts of oil into the engine every day, and I cracked the block in my first month of ownership. I had to borrow another $500 to get it fixed, but the car still had a few disturbing quirks. For an intelligent girl, you can be very foolish, my mother would have said, clucking her tongue in disapproval. But she was far away in Dublin and blissfully ignorant about my troubles. I put the thought out of my head and reflected instead on the romantic poetry class I had just attended and the anthropology exam scheduled for next day. I was a full-time English major, putting myself through college with the help of a half-time secretarial job in the Center for Developmental Disabilities. As a 32-year-old single mother in school with 19-year-olds, I felt somewhat developmentally delayed myself. My son moved unhappily back and forth between me and his dad, spending exactly one half his week with each parent. It was a fractured existence, but I clung to my poetry and literature studies like a drowning sailor to a spar, not sure whether to cry for help or just keep paddling. I was walking toward the rear of the building when I noticed a young man coming toward me. I registered brown hair, slight build, faded plaid shirt. He repeatedly glanced right and left as he approached. Perhaps he's lost or has car trouble, I thought, preparing to offer assistance in my friendly Irish way. Get back in the car, he hissed. I stared at him, hardly able to believe my ears. I looked around quickly, noticing how quiet the usually crowded parking lot was, not a soul in sight. I was about to run in the opposite direction when the man took a gun from his pocket and pointed it at me. It was a small handgun that fit snugly in his palm. The steel barrel caught the sunlight and shone like a jewel. What was I to do? This wasn't a story I had read in a book. It was the real world cutting in, as if the radio of my thoughts had gone suddenly dead. The weapon created an immediate intimacy between us. There was something obscene about its sudden intrusion. I felt the rest of the world, the parking lot full of snow-dusted cars and the red brick office building gilded in the pale light of the afternoon, fall away under my feet. My head felt light, as if detached from the rest of my body. I began to fumble in my bag for the car key. "Don't make me use this," the man said in a shaky voice. "Okay, okay, take it easy," I managed to mumble. I could tell by his face that he was serious. Suddenly, there was no question about what I should do. We both understood the simple, universal language of violence. I got back in the car on the passenger side. He took my keys and started the engine. As we drove down the street, I kept seeing people I knew, but they were oblivious to me. We turned the corner onto Colchester Avenue, and I thought about jumping out at the traffic lights. "Lock that door," the man barked suddenly. I obeyed, sinking back into my seat. Chapter 2. It was far from guns and kidnappers I was reared, as my father might have said. I grew up during the 1950s and 60s in Sallynoggin, a working-class neighborhood about 7 miles south of Dublin City. This was an era in which the ragman, the slopman, and the coalman still came to our doorsteps with horses and carts, and Mr. Byrne, the milkman, arrived on his bicycle to ladle loose milk from a tilly can. In this pre-technological world, stories were our entertainment and our sustenance. The nuns at school terrorized us with tales of leprosy and the foreign missions, black babies desperately in need of baptism, and sudden appearances by celestial beings. The radio brought plays, sponsored programs, and serialized stories for children. There were true stories, too, like the assault by a priest that cost my father his eye, my narrow escape from being sent to an orphanage, and my first cousin's discovery that the woman he had always called Aunt Kathleen was really his mother. Over it all lay my mother's mellifluous but incessant talking that formed the foundation of my literary education.
Thank you very much. That's wonderful. That's a great start. You know, you don't have a very thick Irish accent. Is that because you're from Dublin, or is that because you've lived here so long?
Well, it's because I'm from Dublin, and I think a lot of Americans, saving your presence, of course, expect me to sound like someone from a country area, from Cork, or somewhere with a really strong accent.
Is that the chalk and cheese thing?
It is, in a way. But at the same time, I have lost a lot of my accent. And some of that was just through coming here as a young woman and being incredibly self-conscious and shy. And my son, although he was only 4, criticized my accent and was embarrassed when I sounded too Irish. And so gradually I started leaving out things that sounded Irish because it drew attention to me. Of course, now I regret that, you know, and because people love Irish accents and accents in general. But of course, my accent, I'm even aware of letting my accent out more when I read. Partly because I wrote it for my Irish accent, and because I'm just conscious of allowing it to come out rather than, it's not the same as putting it on. But it's one of the pleasures of being in Ireland is the accents, listening to people, and being able to speak that way again, even though when I go to Dublin everyone thinks I sound like an American. In my own ear I sound Irish.
Yeah, you know? And I'm sure it does come out more when you're there.
Accents are very... Well, they're fascinating to me, really.
Yeah.
You know.
So much of this book is Irish expressions and the things that your parents would say.
Yeah.
And they had wonderful colloquialisms. So that just invites more of an accent.
It does. It does. Absolutely. A lot of it is in the turns of phrase, of course.
Yeah. Do you think that this stereotype of the Blarney Stone and the Irish gift of speech is true? And also, you know, I was going to just mention a few of the colorful expressions that you have in this book. Your father talked about a woman who had a tongue that would clip hedges. You have a lovely story about a man who your grandmother helped, I think, who said, "God bless you and may the giving hand never falter."
Yeah.
And then there was the drunk man in church who yelled at the priest, and then he looked around and said, "That put the cap and cloak on it."
Yeah.
So these were fun, you know, just so much fun.
They're great expressions. They're wonderful. They're very colorful, and they're full of imagery, which is great. It's a funny thing, you know. I when you ask a question like that, I can almost see my brother and sisters rolling their eyes, yeah. you know, and because the last thing anybody wants to be is what you would call stage Irish,
yeah.
which is that sort of Blarney Stone stuff. And of course, Americans are famous for that and for romanticizing Ireland. And
when I think too, yeah. particularly the people like myself of Irish ancestry
oh,
with
yes.
no firsthand experience.
That's right.
And so what
That's
you
right.
heard was right. probably just the stereotype.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
And it's true. And I always think that Irish-Irish and Irish-American are two different cultures.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's a lot in common, obviously. But it wouldn't be fair for me to say that I understood Irish-American culture because it is quite different.
Mm.
And in some ways... often it's that romantic notion that's been preserved through immigrants, but not all of it is positive, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a friend whose parents both came from Ireland. They're dead now, but his father sang the songs, told the stories, and his mother never talked about it. She didn't want to mention Ireland because her experience there had not been a happy one.
Mm.
And so I think there are very different responses to it, you know. And there are people who identify themselves as Irish-American, but not Irish. I mean, it's not
sure,
about the country
sure.
anymore.
Right.
And,
being Irish-American means maybe you grew up in New York and you heard your grandparents' stories.
Right. Or yeah. Philadelphia or right. Boston or somewhere like that.
Sure.
So it's a confusing thing in some ways. I mean, most of the Irish people I know, who just groan at the kind of romantic notions people have, and especially the excruciating experience of having Americans do Irish accents. It's just awful. And it's terrible. But usually I can spot a fake Irish accent anywhere, even after all these years. Although once in a blue moon I've been deceived.
Yeah.
But, with actors and films and... it's so easy. It seems to be easier to go the other way for an Irish person to do a pretty good American accent mm. than the other way around.
Is that just because your ear is different?
It may be, but it may be just the yeah. accent itself,
yeah.
you know.
Well, now, what about an English person doing an Irish accent? Are they better?
Yeah, they're probably better. But, you know, there's a series Daniel and I watched a while ago, a great murder mystery series called Jack Taylor. It's set in Galway.
Okay.
And all the actors are Irish, but I knew that the main actor wasn't. And when I looked him up, indeed, he's from Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But he does a really good Irish accent.
That's
but I just knew there were certain things.
Yeah, I just
so
saw
it's funny.
I just saw Good Will Hunting.
Oh, yes.
For the first time in many, many years. And there's a
yes.
scene where Minnie Driver...
Yeah.
does this Irish joke in an
oh,
Irish accent.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I wonder if she was any good at that. It sounded good to me.
But, you know, again, accents are fascinating. Whether the Irish do have some sort of intrinsic gift of the gab, I don't know. But it's a funny thing because I feel as if I've grown up into a stereotype. As if
yes.
I said, when I grow up, I want to be a stereotype. And yet I never... You know, I never intended to. As a young woman, again, I was shy and bashful and self-conscious. And all of a sudden, I turned into this chatty, sociable, friendly person who talks all the time. And I love to drink, which neither of my parents did. You know, so it is funny. It's the stereotype, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, not all of the stereotypes always have some truth in them.
Right.
But only some truth. I mean, there's always a darker side to it, too.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Speaking of growing into a woman who is more talkative than she
yes.
was as a young woman, reminds me of your mother. Because,
yeah.
as you said in the opening, you had a mother who was talkative and a more quiet yeah. father.
Yes.
How... And again, this is a big subject, and I'm asking you to boil it down, but how do you think each of them affected your decision or your evolution as a writer?
Well, I felt as if I was a lot like my father growing up. I looked like him, and I felt as if I was broody and moody and temperamental. And, of course, various relatives reinforced that. By telling us those things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're just like so-and-so, and mm-hmm. you're like so-and-so. So I internalized it, and I heard it externally, too. But my mother was so talkative that I always felt like I couldn't get a word in, and I was quiet and bookish. So I kind of retreated into books. My father and mother would I mean, they were always actually romantic in my mind. They were very romantic with each other. But they also irritated each other. And often it was about the talking.
Yeah.
You know, my father would get upset with my mother because she just couldn't stop talking. And other relatives would too. Her older brother would just tell her to be quiet. Not that it did any good.
Yeah.
But there would be these little, you know, frictions about talking a lot.
Mm.
And so that got played out in our house. But my father was very much the authority figure, even though he didn't talk as much.
Yeah.
He didn't really need to talk as much.
Because he could stop everything with a look.
Exactly.
Sure.
But, and that's very typical, I think, in some ways. It wouldn't be fair to say it's everywhere, but it's very typical.
Yeah.
It's kind of the strict Irish father. But yeah, it was a source of a friction at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, once I grew out of being so shy and bashful, I became much more like my mother. But that was always there,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was a great storyteller, and he was too, but in a different way.
Yeah.
And then he, in some ways, came into his own after she died.
That was interesting.
Yeah,
yeah, you talk about that in the book, that he, you know, obviously he had to make a big adjustment, but it was interesting, the shift in how he made a new social life for himself, because she didn't run things anymore, sort of.
And it wasn't so much that... that he couldn't get a word in before, as that, you know, in a relationship, you tend to rely on the other person.
Yeah.
Left to your own devices, you really have to go out and make an effort. And, or you'll die of loneliness.
Which a lot of people
he
do.
He almost did. Mm. You know, in the first year after she was gone, he said he was suicidal and terribly depressed.
How old was he when she died?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, she was 74, and he was 5 years younger than her.
Ah.
So,
69.
Yeah.
You write poetry, as you've already mentioned, and you write prose, both. And it sounds like your poetry is storytelling, too.
A lot of it is, yeah.
So I was curious, having written a memoir, if you found a very different reaction from your readers, your audience at a reading, do you find more people come up and approach you as though they know you from having read your memoir than they did as... having read your poetry?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think Daniel and I agreed early on that far more people read prose than poetry in the larger world. And it's a very, very small audience for poetry. So that sometimes people will really respond to poems in a reading, but far more people respond to the memoir. And even my next-door neighbor, I was passing one day a few weeks ago, and she said, "Now I know all about you." And so that was a bit disconcerting. But there is a sense of, I feel as if I was very revealing.
Mm.
Although it's an illusion to think that I've revealed everything about myself. It seems that way, you know.
No, but you do open yourself up to a little bit of vulnerability.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's almost like giving people permission to ask you or to know you or to think they know you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of the poetry, it's a different animal in some ways. Even though it's both, in my experience, are stories, I think that the there's a lot of overlap. And with poetry, I expect the emphasis to be more on imagery and language and some of the other aspects of poetry, the brevity and... really, the imagery is the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there isn't imagery in prose, too, but it's more concise and it's perhaps more vivid.
And it's more explained. I mean, an image in a poem might mean something to you that another person might not pick up on
or will
see their own associations.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And in fact, at the same time when I was writing this, I was working on a poetry manuscript, which I'm hoping to go back to. So I have about a book-length manuscript of poetry.
Mm.
That's waiting to be edited. And I hadn't... It's a funny thing. I think this is, again, just a fantasy on my part. But I wanted to publish nonfiction prose as if to prove something to myself that I'm a real writer.
It's like J.K. Rowling publishing under another name to find out how it would do.
Oh, yeah.
Or Stephen King.
Of course, everyone found out about her, so it didn't really work. But, but it's true. I there's something satisfying in doing that.
Mm.
But it's also because people respond far more than they ever do to poetry. Most people are intimidated by poetry and feel that they can't understand it. It is a shame.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, because whenever I've done readings, people have come up to me and said, oh, I love your poetry. I can understand it. It's so accessible. And that always makes me think, well, perhaps I'm not a real poet. If they can understand it, it must be not quite up to par.
I interviewed Sidney Lee. He said something about, you know, that poetry should at least open something up for a reader. It should, you know, maybe it's not exactly the thing that the poet intended, but it should at least open something up for the reader.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it is why I like people like Billy Collins and Ted Kooser and people who don't believe in being obscure, who purposely set out not to be obscure, you know.
Yeah. When I read the book, I read it that as a young woman you had an eating disorder. So I wondered what aspect of your upbringing would you attribute to your need to find control and seek attention through not eating?
But that's such an amusing question to me. Because never in my entire life have I thought of myself as having an eating disorder. Far from it.
So
I mean, I think I was very perverse as a child. And like a lot of children, I used food to get back at my mother and to have some control. You know, my mother nagged me about food all the time, and so, of course, I resisted. But I became a vegetarian.
So I just read too much into something.
Well, perhaps, but then if you did, probably a lot of other people would, too. And it is funny because I think the idea of eating disorders is very common and among my students and everything else, but I don't think any of us had ever heard of eating disorders in Ireland. My brother would probably say we ate everything we could get our hands on, you know. Mm. But I was just a really difficult kid. And I had airs and graces, you know. And I thought being a vegetarian sounded really cool. And it drove my mother absolutely nuts.
So there was not a phase that we went through where you were sort of not eating very much?
I think I was really malnourished in school, but I didn't do it to
annoy her.
Right. I mean, I ate sweets all the time. I didn't starve myself, but I just wouldn't eat what was put in front of me.
Okay.
So, I think that's fascinating. I suppose you could say I had lots of disorders that weren't identified.
All right. Now, so this is another question about food. You didn't like to cook as a student. You talked about that in the book.
In school,
School.
Oh,
you didn't
good
like
Lord,
to cook,
no.
But later you learned to love cooking, and I find myself curious, given the time of year that I read the book, do you make a Christmas cake? And do you make some of these dishes that were made when you were young?
Well, it's funny. I've gotten so far away from that because of being a vegetarian. And in the 60s and early 70s, when I was a mother in Ireland, I embraced the whole hippie, back to nature, brown rice and veggies, most boring diet in the world. But, you know, that's what we lived on. You know, we, far from being like my parents, I wanted to get as far away from that as I could. So while my parents were, you know, meat and potatoes, ordinary Irish diet, I was doing the hippie thing and making everything from scratch. And I was also influenced, though, by my former husband's family, who were Americans living in Ireland. And they were, you know, these, at least his aunt was a big influence. She was a great friend of mine. She taught me how to bake yeast bread. My mother didn't make yeast bread. She made soda bread.
Mm.
And I do make soda bread. I love soda bread. But this aunt, who was American, of course, I was being very influenced by all of the American-ness going on there. And she taught me how to make yogurt, how to make everything from scratch. It was all of that terribly laborious approach to feeding oneself. But because I had this child and I was home with them all the time and I boiled beans and ground them up and, you know, added brewer's yeast to everything. It was disgusting. And, you know, it was certainly, from a more feminist point of view, it was certainly a way to keep a woman busy from morning till night in the kitchen, you know. And whether it helped or not, I don't know. But it was part of my rebelling against the way I grew up. Of course, later I realized what I was missing, you know. But foolishly, I rejected everything that my parents represented and, you know, embraced all of this kind of American stuff.
Right.
But, you know, my sister in Germany makes a Christmas cake and makes all these things. She's a great cook. And my other sister is a wonderful cook, too. So they do much more of that kind of thing. I have a love-hate relationship with food, I think. I cook if Daniel reads to me. It's a a great deal we've got going as a couple. We've always done that. He likes pies and cookies, and I will only make them if he reads novels to me. And it's great. I recommend it, you know, because I will be very happy cooking while he's reading.
Yeah.
And
he has a good reading voice.
Oh, he's a wonderful reading voice. And, you know, how many people can get someone to read aloud to them? We've read some great novels over the years. And so, you know, we'll start one every now and again. And I just love it.
Do you take turns with the same novel, or does one person do the
whole
novel?
No, you know, the awful part is I would like to take turns, but I'm the one who does the cooking. So
he doesn't have some aspect of this.
And he would rather do the reading.
Yeah.
He likes me reading to him, but it's far more his job to read.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
that's great. I love that. I was going to ask how your poetry and prose each affects the writing of the other.
Well, I think at first I really dipped into the same well for the poetry, into the stories and anecdotes. And a lot of it, though, was images from my childhood that then I fleshed out a lot more in the memoir. But I'm hoping that in my poetry, at least, I'm getting away from that somewhat. I think I don't just want to keep writing the same thing. I want to move away a little bit from just my childhood. Not that it isn't rich, and not that I couldn't go back to that, but I want to, you know, I want to look around at the rest of the world somewhat, too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope that the poetry is informed by that ear for language and caring about language and love of language, but I'd like to move away in terms of subject matter from that.
I would think that being from one place and living in another place will always sort of be a theme for a person
absolutely.
In that situation, like Julia Alvarez comes to mind.
Yes, indeed.
You know, you know, sort of begs the treatment of childhood in the material.
But,
you know, maybe not always.
Well, I'm never sure whether that's just a kind of reluctance to let go of the past and a reluctance to really be in one place. I'm very bad about that. I feel as if I've never rooted myself anywhere, you know. I'm not good at that part. Just emotionally, psychologically, I always feel never quite at home. But I've come to accept that,
right.
You know. It just seems to be the way I am, for whatever reason.
So when you go back to Ireland, or for example, when you took your sabbatical, was there a sense of coming home as well as a sense of displacement while you were there?
Yeah, well, there's a sense of when I go to Dublin, to Ireland, there's this sort of flood of memories that comes back. It's like I'm just flooded with images and memories and sounds and memories of my parents and all kinds of things. And yet I'm not really at home. Living there and renting a place, being able to be there, that was great. Seeing people that I don't usually see. You know, I reconnected with people I hadn't seen for 30 years. And that was wonderful. But I still don't really belong there. And I don't know if I could.
Do you belong here?
No, not really. Although I've come to love Vermont. There's so many things to love about it. I have great friends here. But again, it may be me. Maybe circumstantial. I'm not sure, but I'm fascinated by other writers who struggle with that too. You know, like Amy Tan or other poets who've written about that, the cross-cultural experience or the transition.
Right.
You know,
and it's interesting too when they actually have a language difference as
Always
interesting.
I mean, well, my sisters went through that.
In Germany. Where are they? Both
in Germany? My sister Mary lives in Germany, in northern Germany. She's fluent in German. And I've watched her become more fluent. She didn't speak a word of it when she went there.
Oh, my gosh. And, why did she go there?
Well, various reasons. But she went there when she was a young woman, and she met a German and married him. And he didn't speak English. He still doesn't speak. He speaks some English. But and her sons speak English. But they're apologetic about it, even though their English is so good.
Yeah.
But they always apologize and feel more comfortable in German. Whereas I've watched her go from speaking German to reading in German to watching films in German to making jokes in German. I mean, she is so fluent.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And my other sister lives in Switzerland, but in a German-speaking area in Bern. And the local dialect there isn't German. It's a dialect. And it's not even a written dialect.
Interesting.
So she can make her way in that, but she doesn't love it the way my German-speaking sister does. And she's not as fluent in it either. And the other interesting thing is that we all have odd accents now, but my sister in Switzerland sounds like she just came from Dublin. You know, she has a real Dublin accent, whereas my sister in Germany has a mix of German-Irish. And I have some kind of strange hybrid accent, too. Mm-hmm. My brother is still in Dublin. He sounds the way he always did, you know, like a Dubliner. But we're some strange mix,
yeah.
You know.
Now, you touched on this a little while ago, but since we're talking about your family again, how have your siblings reacted to the book?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, my brother has always been a great supporter, and he was very encouraging. He read a draft of the book, which no one else did, and I asked him for a lot of help because he's a real genealogical mm-hmm. expert. And so he was very helpful with a lot of things. And he's written quite a few wonderful essays himself, sort of family-oriented essays that I wish he would publish. Mm-hmm. My sisters, and my brother comes up in the book a lot more than my sisters. And I think the safest thing to say is that while they wish me well and I'm very close to them, we've more or less agreed not to talk about it.
Because you agree to disagree about what your picture of the past is.
I think they were not too pleased with their mentions in the book. Mm. And I think I was surprised. I thought that I was being very careful. And at first I was hurt by that. Mm. But now I can see why they might have been offended. Mm-hmm. And so we've just, I think, tacitly agreed not mm-hmm. to talk about it.
But maybe it's material that
possibly
you've put behind you, and that's how you moved on.
Yeah. Well, again, I thought I was putting it in terms of the past, and my jealousy of them was my problem, nothing about them. I felt that what I was trying to do, I suppose, was take responsibility myself of any blame that was to be dished out. I felt I was putting it on me, not anyone else. But it may not have seemed that way to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's one of the difficulties with memoir, is that you're invariably telling other people's stories. Mm-hmm. You try not to, but you can't help it.
Right. Well, it's your story, but you're interacting with people. Otherwise, there's not much of a
story
either way.
and it's hard because you have to try not to worry about what people will think.
Yeah.
And really, I don't think there was anything terribly outrageous in my memoir.
Well, you were kidnapped.
Oh, true. Yes. How can I forget that?
What do you like to read? Or what are you reading right now?
Oh, I just finished a wonderful novel by Pete Hamill.
Oh, yeah,
called Snow in August.
Oh, yeah.
And it just came to me. My son loaned it to me. I didn't know anything about it. And it turns out to be about a young Irish kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 1940s and meeting a Jewish rabbi from Prague. And it brought together all of these different things, because my daughter-in-law is from Prague, and my good friend Gail is Jewish, and I've always been fascinated by Yiddish and by the whole Jewish culture. So it brought together all these things, and I just gobbled it up. And I love novels, but I've been teaching creative nonfiction, and I love creative nonfiction. I love writers like Ian Fraser, and I've been reading essays by Jamaica Kincaid, lots of different people. But I love novels. Tana French, I just ate up those murder mysteries.
She's from Burlington, did you know that?
No,
yeah.
You're
so
kidding.
I interviewed her for the show.
You're kidding.
So the people that own Metal and whatever that jewelry
Fire
is downtown.
Fire Metal.
Their last name is French. He's her uncle.
Oh my goodness, I'm so fascinated to hear that.
Was she born in Burlington and left when she was 3 or something?
And she lived in Ireland for a long time.
She does now, I think.
I know she's not Irish. I knew she wasn't Irish.
Yeah.
But her ability to capture the voices and the dialogue is just wonderful.
Fabulous. Yeah.
And then I read, it sounds like I always read murder mysteries, which I don't. I read a wonderful murder mystery called Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, which my son turned me on to.
Yeah.
He also turned me on to the Tana French novels. I'm reading a lot of poetry because I'm going to be teaching poetry writing next semester. But I've also been teaching the short story, and I love short stories, perhaps more than anything else. John Cheever and mm-hmm. John Updike. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been reading Kurt Vonnegut again. I've been revisiting some of his short stories.
Okay.
Students never cease to be interested in Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, I just got a book of his, too.
Oh, yeah. And so I've been having a great time with short stories, because I've been teaching these two classes, and the discussion has been so much fun.
Yeah.
So, lots of different kinds of things.
Great. So, my last question generally is, for my listeners who might be writers, I ask my guest for advice for those writers, and sometimes I sort of ask it in a certain light. We've talked a lot about this, though, and if you want to take it another place, that's totally fine. I was going to ask for writers from another culture, any advice for writing in their new home country or place, or even as visitors, writing about an environment that's foreign to them. Which isn't actually what you did. You wrote from your new place about your home country, but
I really believe that being foreign is a gift. Mm. You see things in a way that other people, natives, don't. And I think there's a great tradition of that, like Julia Alvarez and different people, but also photographers, who come from another country and can observe things that people who live there can't. And so I hope that I've kept that point of view. And it is a real privilege to try to maintain that distance, you know, as if you were seeing everything for the first time. And one thing I think is important to do is just go and look and observe and write down. Just looking. It's a bit like the zen of seeing. I love to go to coffee shops or bars and look at people and eavesdrop on them. I tell my students, you're a writer. You can eavesdrop anytime you like, anywhere you like. So I scribble away in my notebook.
Do you feel self-conscious if you write down dialogue and someone's sitting right next to you?
Not at all, no.
You don't worry, they're going to see
permission.
It?
Oh, no, I'm very devious. I think I'm a writer. I get away with that.
Yeah.
But just observing, it's like exercising a muscle. And I don't do it enough. I think for me, as a writer, I've fallen into spending too much time in the other side of my brain, the practical side, as we all do. And it's important to find ways to go into the other side, the poetry writing, the image creating side. I spend too much time balancing our checkbook and doing online banking and cleaning the house and worrying about those practical things, and teaching, for that matter. And so, I mean, I think music is a great way of going into that other, more creative side. And I don't do it enough. And going outside and getting away from home, for me, no matter how lovely your home is, for me, when I'm at home, there's always this to-do list.
Yeah.
And so that I really have to work at spending time in that other side of my brain. And sometimes that's just by reading, you know, reading poetry or reading something creative, suggestive, you know.
Yeah.
Daniel doesn't have that problem. He can just go straight to work. But I'm afflicted with all of this other interference.
Sure.
And I have to kind of work at it.
Are you a procrastinator by nature?
You know, I've decided that I used to be. Not so much anymore. But when I procrastinate, it's almost always because on some emotional level, I'm afraid of what I need to do, or I'm filled.
Creatively?
Well, I'm just filled with self-doubt and self-consciousness still. I mean, I struggle with that, but I don't have a lot of confidence. I have to really work at it to feel, to give myself permission to do anything creative. Mm. And so it's usually an emotional impediment rather than a time constraint or anything else, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm very good at being busy. And then at the end of the day, emailing, you know, but at the end of the day, you haven't gotten anything done you meant to do. So it's the same issue we all face, you know. I struggle with it a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank
you. I really
had
fun talking to you.
Oh, likewise. It was wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Angela Patton, whose book is called High Tea at a Low Table, published by Windridge Books of Vermont. Next week, my guest will be Vermont poet Daniel Lusk, who happens to be married to Angela. You can learn more about both of them and their work at their shared website, carrigbinn.com, and that's spelled C-A-R-R-A-I-G-B-I-N-N. It's an expression that translates from the Irish as sweet rock. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Battery Street Jeans, where vintage and recycled clothing come together through love. Happy Days, located at 7 Marble Avenue, the south end of Burlington. For more information, check out BatteryStreetJeans.com. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone. BurlingtonTelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. There is no Bookworms calendar this week. I suspect it's because there's a big holiday this week. So no one sent me any events, and the internet research turned up nothing. So you're on your own. Merry Christmas, and read a book. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously shared by my guest, Angela Patton. Write a nonfiction essay or short story that begins, "The moment seemed to go on forever." Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Today it was from 2:05 to 3:05. Sorry about that. The ice out there slowed me down. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.